Hey, listeners, we just want to give you a content warning that we talk about violence, physical and emotional abuse, and sexual violence in this episode. Hello, and welcome to JK It's Magic, a bi-weekly podcast in which two bookish besties read YA fantasy through a critical lens. Why? Because critique is our fangirl love language, and because talking about books is pretty magical. I'm Jessie.
And I'm Kelly.
And today, we're going to talk about The Cruel Prince by Holly Black. It tells the story of Jude, who is stolen from the human world, along with her twin sister and half-sister, to live among the fairies after the murder of their mother. Jude is looking to make a name for herself, but the other fairies see her as nothing but a blip in the universe, worthy of nothing but their scorn. Then Jude becomes a spy for the soon-to-be king, which leads her down the path of murder, poisoning, and bargaining with the fairies.
It's risky business.
Risky business.
What did you think? What's your initial reaction?
In the beginning, I thought the book was super boring. It was so slow, but I kept reading because I had to and because I wanted to know what was going to happen. I think there was a lot that could have been cut from this book, especially in the beginning. That would have really made the pace faster. But once I started to get into it and once Jude became a spy for Prince Dane, it was more exciting.
Way more exciting. Once the Game of Thrones started. I see the reasoning behind that part of the text. To give you a little bit more of the background information and develop what happened, like the Jude Carden dynamic. But I also don't think it was as effective as it could have been.
I don't think we needed as much of it as we got. Like, we didn't need to see her at school so many times.
I think it helped us get to know the character better, Jude better, but it was a little bit slow in the beginning. I agree with what you said about the pacing, but I really enjoyed how dark and twisty this book is, mostly because I'm dark and twisty.
You wouldn't know it from looking at you with your bright purple hair.
I don't present dark and twisty.
No, you don't at all.
But I really enjoyed that part of the book. It was different than anything we've read for the podcast so far, I would say.
I agree. One of the darker stories we've read. Now it's time to talk about all things world building in Through the Wardrobe.
I got the feeling that the world Holly Black creates in this novel is meant to feel very strange and different. There's meant to be this defamiliarization with the reader. When you're reading about this magical world, I think she took a lot of pains to help readers see just how different everything about fairy is from the human way of doing things. It's not just, oh, they have magic. Their perspective about the world, from immortality and like their relationship to food, to power and their relationships to each other. It's just a totally different way of experiencing the world. And they're very other, like with a capital O, other.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up immortality because I don't think I thought about this when I was reading it. Because the fairies obviously have a very extended life in the book. Like, you know, they are going to live forever or so long that it seems like forever, but they don't seem to have, like, I think that causes them to have, like, no regard for someone else's life because there's a lot of murder in this book, like, a lot. I was surprised.
For there being so much murder, the fairies don't seem very afraid of dying.
No, but I don't know why.
I didn't put that together. The relationship to mortality and immortality that the fairies have in this book reminded me of Lord of the Rings, where you can just go to the Grey Havens and decide to like live out your days, I guess, but we don't know how long that is. Maybe they just like vanish.
And can they come back?
I don't know. But then they can be killed in battle.
Right. When we see that with the king, I don't remember what his name is.
Eldred.
Eldred, that's it. We see it with the king. He's like, I'm done being king now, so I'm going to go to this place and just like live out the rest of my days there. But like he has family and kids and stuff, so it's kind of weird. He'd just be like, I'm done with everyone.
I'm out.
I'm out. Yeah, exactly.
Along the same lines, the fairies are so violent and ruthless.
The coronations, I was like, oh my God. Okay, if you've watched Game of Thrones, then I was like, major Red Wedding vibes.
Oh, yeah. No, oh, yeah.
I don't want to spoil anyone for someone who hasn't watched Game of Thrones or read Game of Thrones, but wow.
Those were some of the most exciting scenes, I think, for me.
I think so, too. And part of me is like, oh, that's weird that was most exciting because it was the bloodiest, grossest, most violent parts. And part of me wonders if it was so exciting because so many other parts were just like kind of slow moving.
And also just like so tragic the way Carden reacts to it afterwards, where he like makes this super dark joke of, well, like, I guess that's the benefits of being too like passed out drunk during a coronation, is that you don't get killed.
I know. I feel like, well, I know I don't know that I'm supposed to. Like, I don't know what Holly Black wants me to feel about the characters, but I'm also like, oh, I feel real bad for Carden.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of the time.
Absolutely.
Maybe we're supposed to.
Fairies party a lot. Drinking and drugs are a normal part of the culture, which I thought was interesting, since we find so many things interesting.
Interesting. Everything's interesting. It's all interesting. Yeah, it was, especially because it seems like they, like, the royal family is not on board with how much Carden is drinking and doing drugs, but there's also a lot going on at their parties and the festival or whatever that's happening before the coronation. Everyone's drinking, and the girls are not, Taryn and Jude are not supposed to, are supposed to make sure they don't eat or drink anything that would be cause like drug-like effects. So it's really strange.
Yeah, and then on top of that, if you're immortal in the fairy world's just so dangerous and hostile to you. Like, literally everything can kill you. It's like going to Australia.
I'm never going to Australia.
I probably am.
Yeah, you do that. I hope you make it back. I don't want to continue the podcast without you.
Take care of my dogs. I don't make it back.
The king's successor seems to be chosen with no regard to birth order or gender. I really liked that, even though it doesn't really make any sense. You'd think there should be some kind of something in place.
Instead of like random, like primogeniture is pretty random. Like whoever happens to come out first.
Right. So it's interesting that the king gets to decide, or I guess in some instances it would be a queen, gets to decide who is their successor.
Yeah, that's true. I got this feeling that this is really the first time the crown had been passed, because Eldred, oh no, it was the second time. Mm-hmm. His mom was the first person to unite whatever and make the crown. It definitely leaves room for way more politicking.
Right. But also, can you imagine the sibling like rivalry that would happen because of that? Because whoever the parent who is the king or queen, would like, you would know whoever they picked is probably your parents' favorite. That's kind of sad to think about.
What you mentioned about birth order and gender not really mattering makes me wonder why I even bother to keep succession confined to the royal bloodline. What if you just had a bunch of advisors or your court or whatever, and you picked the person who was most, who you thought was most fit? And then from there, it's like a hop, skip, and a jump to actual democratic rule. So come on.
Yeah, it doesn't really make sense. I guess I do remember in this book specifically them saying something about how the kingdoms won't be united anymore or something like that if someone from Eldred's bloodline is no longer on the throne.
That's true. We're working under a feudal system. Another thing I noticed about the world building is that Cruel Prince is really in dialogue with a very long tradition of narratives about fae and fairies. That we see this in the poems that she quotes at the beginning of the different sections. And we also see this, obviously, in the world building and the magical system. So readers who are familiar with this tradition have access to a whole other layer of meaning in the text versus readers who don't, who aren't as familiar, know less about this lore and might feel a little disoriented. Jessie just raised her hand. And that was my personal reaction, too. Like, I felt a little bit more disoriented. I mean, I could kind of imagine what a goblin looks like from Lord of the Rings, but I mean,
but then I'm same here. I'm taking a lot of that information from watching Lord of the Rings as opposed to, or scary movies as opposed to maybe what the actual lore is supposed to be.
Right. So I'm a Ravenclaw and I decided to look some shit up. Get ready for some knowledge, listeners. Here's a research rabbit hole. It's a pretty short one compared to the one that's coming up. So with the help of the internet, I bring you Fairy 101. Point A. There's a tendency to categorize fairies into seely and unseely courts. So we see this in the novel, and I had no idea what the fuck that meant. So turns out they are light inclined or dark inclined, respectively. So kind of like how elves are separated into light versus dark in Norse mythology, that's what seely in Middle English means, blessed, happy, or lucky. while unseelie means has opposite connotations. So both can still be pretty evil, though, and they still trick humans. It's just, I guess, the tendency towards more mischief versus, like, actually wreaking havoc.
It seems like a distinction within the community of fairies, because yes. Some of the things that the Seelie Court do, I would say, no, that is not, that's not good magic or right. whatever.
Like working in a fairy paradigm, which right, does right. not have the same moral ethical values as humans.
Exactly.
And apparently they also go to war with each other a lot in this, like, lore tradition. Apparently that's really common, so hence the importance of alliances and the recognition of the court and validity of the court in the Cruel Prince. And another thing that's helpful to know are some of the different kinds of fairies: sprites, dryads, nymphs, selkies, kelpies, banshees, elves, gnomes, goblins, and pixies are just some of the different types of fae. And Holly Black mentions even more of them, but I can't remember all of them, so not gonna get into it. And each different type of fae has their own origins. They have their own, like, relationships with each other and descriptions and behaviors. And we will include more information in the show notes. I found some resources.
I didn't think about how one of our mutual favorite books, A Court of Thorns and Roses, but the second one, we get a lot of the fairies in that book. They don't do the Seelie and Seelie Court in the same, they don't do that in that book. But we do see different types of fairies. And I don't feel like we get as much of the background and, like, traditional fairy tales, like the traditional fairy types in that book, as we do in this book.
Right. There's way more of a connection to traditional fairy folklore right. in The Cruel Prince. Yeah.
Now that you're saying all this, I realize I've read quite a few fairy tale stories and I did not think about any of them when I was reading this book.
So you knew more than you thought.
Yeah. And you'll get more when we read more Mortal Instrument books.
Wands out. This is the segment where we discuss all things magic. What really struck me about the magical system, picking up these threads about hostility for humans, etc., that we were talking about just now, is that magic seems really threatening and punitive in this novel and in this magical system generally. It's not like the excitement of, like, I can't wait for my Hogwarts letter so I can learn to do fun spells at, like, boarding school. It's not that sort of magic. I think a way that we can understand how magic operates in The Cruel Prince and in this fairy world is a material expression of the abuse of power. What do you think?
Yeah, I would agree with that. All the magic that's happening in this book seems malicious, and we don't see people using their powers for what we would call good at all.
There's no, like, social justice, I guess, in this world. There's kind of the good versus evil is more just like a different shades of evil.
Right, like bad versus badder, you know? And maybe it's because we're with Jude for the whole book, and because as you said earlier, everything in fairy is dangerous to her and to humans. Maybe if we were from a different perspective, we wouldn't see it in such a negative light.
And we get a little bit of because of her proximity to Cardin, I think we see some of that in her proximity to the Court of Shadows. Being in the Court of Shadows, we see, like, Dane's machinations and things. Mm-hmm. I get the sense that even if you are a fae or fairy, that you also have to constantly be on your guard, regardless of whether you're royal or not.
Yeah, because when she's working in the Court of Shadows and Dane has her kill someone who is a messenger, and that person is just doing their job for some other fairy, it's just, I don't know.
It's all a power play, and I'm just curious, like, what the end game is for any of these people.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the point is. I guess they want to have a time where there's no war, with the exception of
Madoc.
Yeah, he wants war because he's a red cap and that's kind of who he is and what he is. And I guess they've had a time with no war for quite some time because of Eldred's reign. So I guess that's the point, is to have a little more peace.
You mentioned in the notes, like, mind control and glamoring, like, and also the oaths. It just, everything seems constructed magically to be very punitive and to assert your power over someone else.
Right, because when we think of the mind control and the glamoring, they're really taking control away from someone else. And the same with the oath, like, Cardin can't not do what Jude asks him to do.
Yeah, you're taking away his agency.
And Jude, of all people, that was really frustrating to me to see her do that. Jude, of all people. We'll talk about Jude later.
Yeah, we will.
She really made me angry.
And I think, yes. I was staying on track. Sorry. My bad. Anyway, I, again, want to reiterate that I really enjoyed the connections to the rich tradition of fairy lore, and it makes me want to learn more.
Yeah. Let's read some more fairy books.
Let's do it.
Wands away. Now we're going to talk about conflict, villain, and good versus evil in a segment called Get Me Kylo Ren. Let's talk about Taryn. I should start by saying that I think everyone in this book takes some part in being a villain at some point.
I liked that our characters, we weren't just operating in this straight good versus evil paradigm, which makes the book way more intriguing.
Yeah, like we encounter a lot of shitty people. A lot. All the shitty people.
It's just whether or not I'm more aligned with their shittiness than others versus like I'm more aligned with Jude's agenda than I am with Taryn's agenda.
Right. So Taryn is an awful sister. The worst of sisters. I have a half sister. I don't have any sisters that I grew up with. So this is coming from my preconceived notions of what a sister should be. Instead of trying to help Jude or comforting her sister, Taryn tells Jude to give up what she wants so as not to upset Carden. And she doesn't tell Jude that she's going to marry Locke. And
Taryn is out for Taryn. And she's been using her sister in order to fulfill her own agenda. So I guess props for being committed.
I guess. But it's funny because she makes this distinction, Taryn almost makes this distinction about the difference between being human and being fairy. But you can see how she never really tells Jude a lie, because the fairies can't lie. She just kind of walks around her words in such a way that...
Yeah, they're lies of omission, basically.
Right. But she does it a lot. Like, everything she says to Jude is a lie of omission.
It's interesting because when you go back, after you get the revelation of what Taryn's been doing the whole time and what her plan with Locke was, or her deal with Locke was, then I went back and was thinking about all of the other interactions Taryn had.
Right.
And you just realize how manipulative she was at every step of the way.
Right. And I guess it's hard because when you think about being young and being in love, I think you're probably more manipulated by the person that you love. And that's what's happening with Taryn. Locke is manipulating her into tricking Jude.
He's super manipulative. He's awful.
He's the worst. But I think I just want to like take Taryn and shake her and say, what are you doing? This is your sister. Why are you being such a little shit? You know, like, get it together, man. She's a bad sister.
Taryn's trying to belong and going for power by aligning herself through marriage. And we see Jude and Vivi doing other things. But that part of those decisions lead to Taryn's, like, part of her villainy, I guess.
Yeah. I am interested to see what will happen with Taryn in the next book. Part of me thinks that her and Locke won't actually end up together. Something's going on there. I don't know. We'll see.
That's super up in the air. Yeah, I don't. That doesn't seem...
When is this next book?
They're not
book
like
come
my
out?
OTP. Like, they're not going to figure it out.
No,
I don't think.
I hope they don't. She doesn't deserve to be happy now.
Yeah, and he's not going to make her happy, though. So if she stays with him, she gets hers, I guess.
One, it's hard because I think we also see in Fairy a lot of, like, polyamorous relationships. Like, that doesn't seem to be out of the norm that people are in marriages, but also in relationship with other people. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it's accepted polyamory or if this is just adultery, but I don't think that Taryn's going to end up happy being not the only person that Locke is with. Jude is really, really violent, and she believes it was either witnessing the murder of her parents or having lived with Maddox for so long, neglecting the idea that she was born this way. And I thought that was interesting. I just thought it was funny, this kind of idea of nature versus nurture within Jude and her villainy. But she doesn't want to accept that it's possible that this is just who I am and maybe I'm not a symptom of my circumstances.
Or even beyond that, she's making decisions and doesn't seem to be taking responsibility. She's like, oh, this was my path.
Right.
Whether or not that's a nature or nurture determined. But she's the one making those decisions in that moment.
Right. But she doesn't seem to realize she's doing that. Almost as if she thinks all of this is predetermined for her. Like there was never going to be any other way but for her to do these things or be this way.
Right. Which kind of makes me sad. I wish that she would realize how much agency she has.
I'm wondering if she'll realize that more in the next book because she has... Now she has control of the king, so she'll be the one making kind of these big decisions that are affecting all of Faerie, which is also really shocking because it's a human who's going to be in charge of the Fae.
Jude kind of reminds me of Betty from Riverdale, where we've got that like darkness, but we don't really know where it comes from.
Right.
And there is that question of, is it nature or nurture?
That's true. But I love Betty.
I know you do.
I don't love Jude. So I guess we kind of like tiptoed around this a little bit in that Jude kind of feels like villain adjacent to me. She's obviously not the villain of the story, but she's bloodthirsty. She's very interested in gaining power above anything else. She tricks Cardin into taking the throne, knowing that he really doesn't want anything to do with it. Her taking that away from him, that decision away from him, I think is what really infuriated me the most.
It was a big violation of trust and consent.
Especially because she was taken away from the human world against her will. So I was surprised that she would then do something similar to someone else.
Yeah, I agree about not liking Jude in the way that I like other protagonists of other series, like Aelin from Mass's Throne of Glass series, for example. But I know that this is a deliberate choice on Holly Black's part. Like, this is all machined and tailored in the like construction of the novel. And what this really made me think about is like, how many male characters do we have from stories the world over that aren't traditionally likable? Men can be anti-hero asshole protagonists, but female protagonists are typically constrained to likability, not to mention sexiness.
Yes.
So we don't see Jude sexualized, really. She's not constructed to be a particularly likable character. And so I think I came to the conclusion while I was writing these notes that I like that I don't like her because she's rough and ruthless and exasperating, but I think that's great.
I think it's good to have unlikable characters, especially main characters, because I do feel bad for Jude. She had a shitty upbringing. She's had a shitty life in Faerie.
Got some serious Stockholm syndrome going on, basically.
Right. Yeah, because she obviously really wants to be a part of that world. She's working to become a knight and a person in power. She wants to be the right hand to the king, who, you know, gets murdered, so he's not going to be the king anyways.
And she talks about how she loathes herself.
Right. Yeah.
And it's not that different from Cardin's loathing of her, where because she's mortal. And
right.
So it's really interesting how her entire worldview has changed.
Do you think she hates herself because she's mortal and not fairy and she wants to be part of the world? Because
she's weak. I think she sees humanness as weakness. Hence all of her power grabs and her, I mean, she uses the one thing that she can do that fairies can't, which is lie.
Right. It's interesting then that she takes Oak and takes him into the human world because she obviously thinks there's something about humans. I don't want to say that gives them a sense of humanity that the other fairies don't have, but there's something the humans have.
I think she's getting to like compassion and empathy and like a perspective that's less egotistical and selfish. And what your point that you mentioned about clearly Jude sees something in the human world that she wants Oak to develop those qualities in order to be a better leader. So she sees the qualities of humans as far as like empathy or compassion or like a bigger perspective, like seeing the bigger picture more and going beyond personal power struggles as necessary for a leader.
Right.
But like the means to her end are the exact opposite. So she's doing the exact opposite of what she would want a leader to actually be.
And one of the complaints she has about Oak is that he uses his powers against her. He can control people without their consent,
which is exactly what she's doing. Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so that's one of the things she complains about. I think part of her taking Oak into the human world is showing him maybe you don't have all this control, you know. But yeah, she's doing it to Cardin, and that's what makes her a villain to me. You got some work to do, Jude.
You brought up this question of belonging, and I moved it to the villain section because I think it motivates our characters to do bad things. What do you think?
I agree. I think Jude, Taryn, and Vivi are all dealing with what it means to belong. Vivi, obviously, for some reason, she really wants to be in the human world. And that's where she thinks she belongs, even though she sticks out the most in the human world.
She can glamour herself, though, so no one can tell.
Yeah, but there are some things, like, June makes it seem like she can't glamour her ears. I don't know. Either way, I think it's interesting that all three of them are dealing with this sense of belonging in a way that, and they all think they belong somewhere different, even having come from the same upbringing and dealing with the same. Obviously, Vivi has some different struggles than the other two. I'd really like to get more of her perspective. She seems like the best of the sisters.
Mm-hmm.
But Taryn wants to be fairy. She wants to live in that world and be an upper class person in that world. And I think that's why she ends up with Locke. Vivi wants to be in the human world. And Jude wants to be a knight in the fairy world. So it's very strange, all their choices being different and dealing with something similar.
Absolutely. Listeners, just as one does not simply walk into Mordor, one does not simply read fantasy without talking about representations of race, class, and gender, and other stuff. This is our segment about power and bodies and how they relate. We're going to start off talking about class.
Switching it up today. Class first. Only the children of the gentry are guaranteed an education. I don't know how I feel about, well, obviously I don't think that's okay. I know I feel that that's bad. But I was kind of surprised to see a world where so many people are interacting and having different kind of jobs within the society, that it's only the people who are in the highest of class would be educated.
And I got the sense that the servants and the spies are your, quote, uglier fae. So that beauty, again, is related to being upper class or royal.
That's a good point. Yeah, I didn't even think about that. I like the interactions we get in the class, because I think the rest of the fairies, even though Taryn and Jude are Maddox's children, like adopted children, they obviously don't think they belong there. And I think it's because the humans are seen as the lowest class, even like outside of fairy. There also seems to be some type of hierarchy based on the type of fairy you are, but there are so many different types that I couldn't keep them straight in my mind. But Jude seems to be able to tell them apart based on what the fairies look like.
Yeah, we get the sense that there's this sort of layer of knowledge, like almost like an institutional knowledge. Once you spend more time in that world, you kind of like learn what's a better fairy to be. Right. Kind of like how studies have shown that children know that it's more beneficial to be white,
right,
before they can even articulate that racism is a thing.
Yeah.
Or that you have more chances when you're a boy rather than being a girl. Like that sort of stigma and like your typecast into different roles and stereotypes. I get the sense that like that similar learning curve would happen in fairy, where you learn where you fit in this hierarchy.
And I guess that probably it impacts Jude, Taryn, and Vivi's sense of belonging, because Vivi is half fairy, half human, and then Jude and Taryn obviously are human. So I bet that impacts a lot of how they interact with other fairies. I wish we had seen Vivi interact with other fairies. I wonder how they treat her as someone who is half fairy, half human.
That's a good question. I don't know. I hope for the next book that we get multiple POVs, one, and that we get to see a little bit more of how the fairies interact with each other, because we're seeing everything filtered through Jude's perspective.
Right. And most of the fairies she interacts with are either the spies who are only interacting with each other, or they're the people from her class and the upper class fairies. So we see how they interact with each other, but we don't really see people from different classes interacting very often. Or if we do, it's, you know, slave to fairy, which is a very different interaction.
And we don't really get to see how the other courts interact between themselves.
Oh, exactly.
Like how those hierarchies might be different in a different court.
We do see, I think we see one of the courts that Jude brings over to her side, and the fairy from that court has a partner who is human. And I think that's about as much as we get of that. So yeah, I hope we get that in the next book. I want to see them interact with each other.
Moving on, to questions of gender.
So it didn't seem to me that fairies had gender norms like we think of them. There's no argument against Jude becoming a knight due to her gender.
Fair point.
I thought that was really surprising.
And we see one of the princesses being more of like into hunting and stuff. Kind of like your Diana sort of figure.
And one of the princesses was up to be the next queen, as opposed to it only being the sons that were considered.
That's true. But we do still get a lot of binary gender performance, I thought, in the novel, like from Oriana and Nicasia and Taryn, and that one royal sister who likes art, but I forget her name. So I think we get some of those more typecasting based on gender, but I agree that it seems to be less entrenched in fairy. Or maybe it's just differently entrenched.
Right, because the women are still expected to have children. Well, one of the spies is a woman.
I don't really know. Like, maybe we're projecting maybe human, anthropocentric, gender binary on a different species that doesn't have that.
That's true.
Maybe they reproduce in other ways. I don't know. I get the sense that we still have sexual reproduction with fairies.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that people with, like, that would identify as female are having the children. Yeah, I don't know. I think because the most recent fairy book I read was ACOTAR, I just go, oh, they identify male, female, and instead of like woman, man. I just think I project that onto this book.
Yeah, there's sort of I think there's a tendency to kind of animalize rather than, it's this weird hybrid mix of animalizing / humanizing this other type of being.
Probably because oftentimes in all forms of fantasy, I think other types of like species, I think like we would consider them different species, look human. We don't get like aliens or other beings that look different enough from us that they don't have human-like qualities. They're always described with human-like qualities.
There's definitely a tendency in fiction, whether that's science fiction or fantasy or speculative fiction more generally, to create anthropomorphic others. So to impose either human physical traits or ways of organizing civilization, values, moral systems.
Communication.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because even when you think of like the wider range of fantasy and science fiction movies and TV shows, aliens even are depicted as, they always have human-like qualities. They have hands and arms and legs. And I think that's kind of a strange thing to assume that other beings would necessarily look similar to us in that way.
Yeah, I'm actually teaching a class on this right now. I actually just talked about this last week with my students. And there are some depictions of aliens that are very different, like in Arrival.
Yes, that's what Arrival. I was thinking of too, is different.
But there, it happens in some sci-fi too. Just depends on the person who's writing it. There's a lot of like theory and stuff about like, oh, how do we just create others and describe others in our fiction? And you either tend to humanize them or you try and do this like mental leap to figure out a different way of being. And the Netflix documentary Explained about extraterrestrial life kind of gets into different like possible ways of other life communicating and living and stuff. So it's a really interesting conversation.
Yeah, that is interesting.
I want to talk about one other thing that is related to, or can be related to gender, isn't always, but Jude actually talks about having a period. She actually talks about menstruating and having to go to the human world to get tampons.
Yeah.
Because apparently they don't have that many like resources or ways of dealing with having a period in fairy because they don't menstruate that often.
Right. I think she mentioned something about them menstruating like once a year. Something that sounds better.
And I do just want to make clear that like not all women have periods and not all people who have periods are women.
Right.
So
yeah.
Decoupling sex and gender and menstruation from gender. And another thing Jude talks about is like actual like sweating.
Right.
And how she's worried about feeling unattractive and that like her humanness, which is like her, I guess some of her biology is like repulsive to her. That was unexpected for me.
Yeah, it's funny because I just read an article recently about by about an author who I haven't read before. She's a famous fantasy writer that I haven't read, and I'm trying to think of her name now, and now I can't remember. But she talked about how in her fantasy novels, it was really important to her to make sure that there were depictions of women going through struggles that maybe we don't normally see in fiction, like them having their periods or going through puberty, and how important that was to make other girls feel like this isn't something you should be ashamed of, and this is something that we should be seeing in our fiction, to kind of normalize it. Because I do think a lot of times women are made to feel ashamed about their bodies, even though it would be things that we have absolutely no control over. Yeah, I'm glad you put this in the book.
Yeah, we'll try and find that article and put it in the show notes.
I will. I think you know who the author is.
Is it Tamara Pierce?
Yeah, I think so.
Makes sense.
I'll find the author. I'll find the article. Something else that goes along with gender. Women should not bear the responsibility of protecting men's feelings.
Fuck that.
Taryn wants you to protect Cardin's feelings at all costs. And I think this might have a lot to do with Locke manipulating her. But Jude's not responsible for how Cardin feels. Cardin is responsible for how Cardin feels. And this really made me angry. There's a lot of anger in this book. I was angry a lot.
Everyone's angry in this book. It made me angry. Yeah. That's okay. Anger can be channeled to create change.
True.
I have Rebecca Traister's Good and Mad sitting on my desk. It's about the revolutionary power of women's anger and about how a lot of changes that have come about, like social justice changes, have been because women get angry and they organize. But to your point about women bearing the responsibility of men's feelings, it just, you know, when I read this, I was like, oh, yeah, men need to start doing their own emotional work. If you identify as a man and you want to consider yourself an accomplice to feminism and the liberation of women, like WOMXN, not just women with an E, then this is incredibly important. Do your work.
Yeah. We're not your therapists.
Go pay one.
Or pay me. I will be your therapist if you want to pay me.
Otherwise, but I'm not certified in any way.
No, I'm not. Otherwise, fuck off. Let's talk about race.
Let's.
Heather, Vivi's love interest, is brown. Explicitly described as brown, not golden skinned. I was very happy.
Along those same lines, I was curious if you also found Jude and Taryn to be racially or ethnically ambiguous. So their last name's Duarte, which is not your typical white, dusty white name. So possibly Mexican, Central, South American heritage, Chicano, Chicana, Chicanx, Latino, Latina, Latinx, don't know, maybe Filipino, also because of the legacy of Spanish colonialism in the Philippines. So those names, like Duarte would be a name that could come from the Philippines. So is this supposed to cue me into thinking that they aren't white? Because I'm here for that, but I wish I knew more and that the racial and ethnic identities of those characters were further developed.
I agree. When they mentioned their last names, I thought they aren't white people, but we don't get any descriptions that mark them as explicitly non-white like we do for Heather, Vivi's love interest. So I'm hoping in the next book we'll get some more descriptions, but I also don't remember any explicit descriptions of glowing white skin or any of those things that we normally get.
Me either. So I was frustrated at myself then, right, for projecting whiteness on them.
Yeah, we do default to whiteness.
I know. I need to do more work. Yeah. Clearly, like, I can't default to that.
Right. So I hope that they're something other than white, mostly because I think we need less white characters, more brown characters. But yeah, it's not explicit, and I thought that was strange. Humans are seen as the lowest of race/species, and they are the minorities among the fairies. So do you think we're supposed to read them as minority characters? Like, as
humans?
Mm-hmm. Like, in the way that we would read a POC, is that how we're supposed to read the humans within fairy?
I'm not quite sure how to untangle the race/species conversation dynamic that's happening here, because I know that they're supposed to be, humans and fairies are distinguished as different species, but there is a discourse of race almost imposed on it,
right?
So I don't know if you can untangle the two. To me, it just seems like a parallel to race,
right?
I would say, because there's like a separate but equal/not equal thing going on with the human world and fairy, and clearly the fairy think that they're superior. And the human world don't necessarily know that the fairies exist. And it seems like fairies can just trick humans into enslavement whenever they feel like it. So there's huge divide between them, like in power, as far as this fairy having way more power to exercise their will over humans who are like basically totally uninformed and ignorant.
I wonder, thinking about the slavery aspect, if that's how we're supposed to see the fairies, like the white people who came and stole black bodies from Africa, like they're enslaving humans.
It seems like they can basically just trick them and take them. Like we see that with Sophie, with the one enslaved human that Jude tries to rescue.
Right.
About that she was at Burning Man and ate a grape or something. Very much reminded me of that scene in Pan's Labyrinth where the Ophelia eats a grape and then the monster wakes up and comes after her.
I haven't seen that movie.
It's good. I just ruined a scene for you.
I probably won't watch it because it looks scary.
It's scary. So, like, clearly there's violations of consent. There's, I don't know, there's just a huge abyss of, like, between the amount of power that humans have and the amount of power that fairies have.
Right. Well, and thinking about the slavery part, and Sophie, she throws herself into the, like, not, it's not an ocean, I think it's a lake, but it reminds me of Killmonger's speech at the end of Black Panther.
Oh my God. Such a good point.
So maybe there is supposed to be a parallel there that I didn't think about until right now. But then Sophie comes back. The fairies bring her back, which was also really strange.
She's like zombie Sophie.
Yeah, but like a mermaid zombie? I don't really know.
I went down another rabbit hole. Sorry, not sorry. None of us are surprised here. About thinking of Taryn and Jude as transracial adoptees. So they're living in a world that devalues what they are, and they learn to value the traits of the hegemonic culture. And Taryn and Jude both do this because they hate being mortal and each go down extreme paths to assimilate into fairy and fairy culture. This kind of was paralleling to me Black Indigenous people of color, BIPOC, who live with white families, forcibly or not, and then whiteness becomes something to aspire to. And this is like one of the ways whiteness reinforces itself via like all these different mechanisms, which is one of the reasons why white supremacy is so entrenched as a system. I was curious if you had thought about that at all.
It's funny that I didn't. But I do think that you're right. And I do think it's why we see Jude and Taryn especially struggling with their sense of belonging, because they are taken from their home to a place that they don't belong. I don't know how I feel about it. It's hard for me because I do think there are so many children who need to be adopted and need good homes, but often that means assimilating to a culture that is not theirs and giving up their own culture.
Yeah. The rabbit hole continues. Taryn and Jude's situation is more in the vein of forced adoptions rather than, I guess, transracial adoptions just generally. But I mean, obviously there are systemic problems that make it so children of color are taken away from their communities because those communities are like over policed and held to like blamed for the problems that white people created in those communities. But Indigenous children from all over the world experience this on a wide scale, this forced adoption. So you can see Canada's forced adoptions that happened. And that shit is going down right now with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the subsequent like financial payouts and like legal battles that have been going on in Canada, or like the stolen generations of Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. And of course, real forced adoptions of Indigenous children are 1,000,000% more pernicious and violent and sinister than the one case we see in the book, since they're a strategy of erasing Indigenous peoples and traditions from the face of the earth. But it's one strategy of many. It's just important to clarify. And so we're going to settle in for a few minutes and talk about the role the United States government has played. I think this is important because as an American, and particularly for me as a white American, I figure the least I can do is find out more about my own country's history on the issue. You ready?
I'm ready.
So I'm just going to talk about the mid-1900s to now, since this shit has been happening for centuries, since way before the United States was the USA. Between 1941 and 1978, it is estimated that between a quarter to a third of all First Nations children in what is now the United States were separated from their families, communities, traditions, and histories. Thousands and thousands of children. So how did this happen exactly? A lot was due to the creation of the Indian Adoption Project in 1958 by the Child Welfare League of America, or the CWLA, and this was a response to widespread poverty and abuse on reservations. And so they responded to that by out adopting, which is a term that's for permanently placing Indigenous children with white families, so adopting them out of the communities. And according to a 2012 report called Truth, Healing, and Reconciliation Forums by the First Nations Orphan Association, there's this quote: "The policy of out adoption intentionally placed Indian children with white families with the assumption that they would have a better chance at succeeding if they were separated from the unfortunate conditions of reservations. This practice differed entirely from all other adoption policy at the time, which favored, quote, matching children with adoptive families who shared similar traits, especially race or religion. Indian children, it was presumed, were in special need of being, quote, saved from their roots, end quote. So plenty of other groups did this, like Catholic Charities and Lutheran Social Services. It wasn't just the CWLA. And so instead of asking why the conditions on reservations were so dire, hint, it's because of the legacy of colonialism and genocide that this country was built on. So instead of trying to figure out what was wrong and try to undo all the damage by actually helping those communities, white people got all white savory and systematically removed Indigenous children from their communities, thereby blaming Indigenous people for problems white people created in the first place. And in 1978, the Indian Child Welfare Act was passed to try and keep this system from doing this sort of damage on such a widespread scale to Indigenous youth in their communities. But as of 2003, three times as many Indigenous children were in foster system per capita compared to white children. So clearly the work's not done, it's still happening. And in the show notes, I'll include links to resources as well as Native activists and voices you can follow on social media. Okay, now I'm gonna let Jessie talk, if she has anything to say.
I have nothing to add. That was well-researched, and thank you for sharing your knowledge with us. I didn't know a lot of those things.
I didn't either until I looked them up. One more thought I had about adoption is that forced adoptions don't just happen to Indigenous children. It's not just like a racial ethnic question. Sometimes they can happen for political reasons. Like during the aftermath of Spain's Civil War, which was from 1936 to 1939, when the fascist winners took children from the Republican side, the losing side, and gave them to supporters of the dictatorial nationalist regime. And this also happened in Argentina during the violent upheavals that were happening there in the 60s and 70s, which is called the Guerra Sucia, or the Dirty War, when children were again taken from the opposition and forcibly adopted to supporters of the militaristic regimes. I don't know. It was another parallel I thought of.
Yeah, a lot of things to think about if you want to adopt. I didn't even think about all these things. Very interesting.
Food for thought.
Food for thought. Thanks for sharing, Kelly.
Welcome.
Now we're going to talk about bodies. Maddie kills his former wife because she left him.
Don't do that.
Maybe don't kill anyone unless they are threatening to harm you or your pets.
Or your fur babies.
Yeah.
Yeah, this from Maddie was just another example of men's violence against women. Even though Maddie only had a sword when he came into that house, it seemed like he just had all of the power.
Well, it's difficult because even if he didn't have the sword, he could force them to do anything he wanted if they weren't wearing the rowan berries. So he was always going to have all the power because he can force people to do whatever he wants. But also, don't bring weapons into someone else's house, people. Not necessary.
Yeah, the book started off with a bang, then got a little slow, and then got more exciting.
Yeah, and I think that we don't see Jude dealing with this in any good way at all. She obviously has not dealt with the emotional toll seeing both of her parents murdered in front of her has taken on her. And that has to, I mean, I know I dislike Jude, but I think a lot of her problems would be solved by, like, not solved, but helped, assisted by some good therapy. Which leads us into Jude and mental illness. Jude never dealt with the mental trauma of witnessing her parents' murder, and that seems to manifest into strange thoughts and feelings towards families. When she says she wants to scare children, she sees with their families at the mall. Jude is happy to feel empty. She works really hard to keep so many different things bottled up, her emotions, words, and thoughts. And some of that is keeping her from thinking about bad memories or to keep her anxiety at bay, but probably not the best way to deal with trauma.
I think they're coping mechanisms, but not necessarily mechanisms for healing. And on top of all of that, Jude keeps experiencing traumatic events, her past aside, her distant past aside. So one, what's-his-face almost suffocates her with fairy fruit when the entire class and teacher watches. What's-his-face, Valerian? I think that's his name. 2, Valerian corners Jude in the tower, physically assaults her, and would have forced her to jump to her own death had Jude not been under Dane's Gesh that protected her from enchantment. So Jude stabs him to save herself. 3, shortly afterwards, Valerian breaks into Jude's room and nearly succeeds in killing her. Jude kills him and has to A, hide his body, and B, move and bury the body and keep that a secret. 4, Jude tried to rescue Sophie, an enslaved human, but Sophie kills herself, and Vivi and Jude spend the entire night trying to find her, like trying to find her body. And then 5, Jude stabs herself in the hand because Dane told her to. All of that shit, it just like keeps happening to her. And then she's worried for the safety of like Oak, her little brother. Yeah, no. It's a lot of stuff happens to her. This is, like I said, dark and twisty.
Which is hard because I think by Jude ignoring all the trauma she's gone through is what really turns her into a villain, because she's not willing to deal with the past or deal with anything. She doesn't want to ask for help from anyone. And it kind of festers and turns her into a bad person.
Yeah. And what I think Holly Black does so masterfully in this story is she weaves this plot to where the high road isn't available. Like, it's just not. A lot of the time she's like has a choice between, you know, 2 equally bad things.
Right. And I think it also makes Jude feel like she has no other option but to exert her control over Cardin in the end, because she's not even willing to ask him if he'd be willing to do this. I think that's because she doesn't think there's anyone she can trust. And that kind of leads us to talk about the emotional and physical abuse of Cardin, which also leads me to want to talk about the emotional abuse of Jude a little bit. This was really difficult for me to read, and I saw a quote from someone recently talking. This was on Twitter. I think it might have been D-Ray McKesson. If you don't know who that is, like, look him up. I'll put him in the show notes. He's
Pod
the best.
Pod Save the People. Yeah. Black Lives Matter. Awesome guy.
Love him. But someone was talking about how seeing so much violence as a child makes you think that violence is what gives you power. And I think we see a lot of this with Jude.
Totally.
And that, like, it's like, that was really hard to read, the emotional and physical abuse of Cardin, because I think it leads him to being emotionally and physically abusive.
He's not abusive in the same way. He's not as overtly physically abusive.
No.
He's more of like an emotional and mental, like just manipulator. And obviously that's abusive, or can be. I would say Jude becomes way more abusive than Cardin.
Oh, definitely. I think she thinks that violence gives her some sense of power, and being able to like wield a sword is what ultimately gives someone the upper hand in all situations. And maybe this is part of her living with Matic.
What you bring out about Cardin just, yeah, reminds me of the whole cycle of abuse again. And we're only recording episode 8, yet this is something we've seen with a lot of characters already, and particularly male characters. See it with Jace. We see it with Anon.
I have to say that I think the cycle of abuse can be a very difficult one to get out of. But I do almost wish that we saw more of this with female characters, because I do think a little bit of always making it the male characters who are suffering the cycle of abuse kind of pushes women out of the picture of having experienced physical and emotional abuse in their past. So props to Holly Black for including Jude in that narrative.
Yeah, because it really is a shared struggle, no matter which side of it you're on.
Exactly.
To healing, you have to heal both sides of the equation.
Yeah, I agree. I feel bad for Cardin, and I probably will for forever. That poor boy. I guess he's probably a man. He's probably old.
He's probably like 400.
I know. But he's like the youngest child. He's dealing with a lot.
Yeah, it's a different paradigm.
Yeah.
Listeners, today we're bringing you a brand new segment, and we're calling Why Though, in which we discuss facepalm-worthy moments that crop up in the books we read. I had 2 main Why Though's in this book. 1, was Jude ingesting all the poisons at once after reading like 1 Wikipedia article about Mithridatism, which is the like how you build up your own immunity against poisons. Learned a new word. Girl, make a spreadsheet or something and space that shit out if you don't want to die. 2nd Why Though moment for me was the twin sisters sword fighting in the living room about a dude scene. Like, why though? Who gives 2 shits about this asshole log? He lies, manipulates, and basically just wants a menage a trois, after which he would dump both of you. Have fun being married to him, Taryn.
Yeah. Although I'm not sure the fight was specifically about Locke.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was about Taryn lying to her sister.
I think these bitches are like 16 years old and they don't have any perspective.
You're probably right.
I'm not attributing any sort of noble motives. Maybe if they like sat down and did some journaling or therapy, they would realize that it was like the sisterly betrayal that really made them angry.
I don't think they have the skills to even know that that is what they're fighting about.
But Locke is the first fairy that makes Jude like feel worthy. She's an object of sexual desire, and that like basically makes her feel like she has worth as a human being.
Which is so frustrating, because your sense of being should not come from someone else.
No, which I think is like, she learns that clear. Like, I think this is
a big
teachable moment for her.
Or we're going to find out in the next book she didn't realize that at all, and she's still fucked.
God, I hope she fucks that guy over. What an asshole.
He's the worst.
Finally, it's time for Shipwrecked, a segment about asexuality, sexuality, sex, romance, and relationships. And sometimes we take liberties and do some shipping of our own.
Vivi is bisexual.
Yay!
That's all I had to say. I was just happy.
And what I found fascinating is that Jude's exposition implies that Maddock wouldn't be upset with Vivi dating women, but would be more upset with the fact that she's dating a human woman.
Yeah. We're in a lot of that in the books, too. A lot of them not okay with interracialness
speciesist.
Okay, well, that one sounds weird. I'm not condoning like
bestiality.
I don't condone bestiality, and I'm not condoning incest, despite what some people might think from last episode.
There's also a tension, which you mentioned earlier, between monogamy and polyamory in the text. And on the one hand, clearly monogamy is still a primary paradigm. Maddock would be the perfect example. Like, he feels scorned because his wife left him and then decides to go kill people about it. But on the other hand, it seems accepted that male members of the royal family have various female consorts. So we see it only with male members of the court doing that, and only in heterosexual relationships with female fairies. This strikes me as kind of mimicking what happened in royal courts, like, all over Europe, or even the world, probably, because patriarchy's everywhere, where men could have mistresses, but women were held to this ridiculous virgin whore dichotomy. So is polyamory for the fairies that identify as female stigmatized, or is it allowed? I don't know.
I don't know either. It should be allowed for whoever wants to do that.
And isn't a consensual polyamorous relationship.
Yeah, consenting, because you can't be out there not telling your person and they think you're just the two of you. That's not okay. Not cool.
Certainly monogamy doesn't reign quite as supreme in fairy as it does in the human world.
Definitely not. I wonder if we see Jude and Cardin together, if that will come into play at all.
Oh, I'm all here for if they decide to like depict a consensual polyamorous relationship. That'd be great.
I just wonder. We don't get that much polyamory in books.
None. It's a huge taboo still.
Watch season 2 of Insecure if you have not. See them deal with that a bit.
Ooh, I haven't watched it. I'll have to watch it.
Oh, yeah. Watch it. So good.
There's also a good Why Are People Into That is a podcast. And there's a 2-part episode about polyamory where the person interviews a sex therapist and also a therapist who specializes in like queer community and polyamory. So interesting. Cardin and Jude's relationship, if you can call it that. They have a relationship. They have a ship of relation somehow. I don't really know. I don't really even know where to start with this. It's like a strange attraction repulsion dynamic that's more dark and twisted than anything I've seen before in YA.
I am especially fond of enemies to lovers stories.
Oh, I love that shit.
I don't know why, but yeah, Cardin and Jude is a whole nother level of enemies to lovers if they get together. The problem is I don't really want them together. I don't really want them together because they're both terrible people, and maybe they deserve each other, but I think they need to do a lot of emotional work before either of them should be in a stable relationship.
Or they're just going to keep doing damage.
I assume in the next book it's just going to get way worse. Or hopefully not. I hope Jude just doesn't force him to do anything he doesn't want to do.
Oh, that would be so hard if they like have sex.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't know that I've read any other Holly Black books, or if I have, it was a long time ago. So I don't know if we'll get any sexy times. But please, 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 Jude, don't force Carden to do something he doesn't want to do.
This brings me to my next point that I'd written down here, that both of these characters need some serious sexual liberation. They, like, Jude hates herself and her humanness and is, like, repulsed by herself. And Carden hates himself for finding a mortal human woman sexually attractive. And it kind of made me think about kink. And, like, it seems like humans are Carden's kink. I also get some, like, Dom sub vibes from this Jude Carden thing. Not with, like, the specific oath, necessarily.
Right.
But just, like, Jude being puppet master and Carden, like, maybe wanting to submit.
She's, like, forcing him to kneel so that he can be crowned by Oak.
But the fact that, like, even if you took the oath out of it, I think I still get dominant and submissive dynamic from this narrative.
And you think that Carden is the submissive?
Yes. I think Jude as dominatrix, Carden as sub, and this would make for great fanfic.
Yeah, it would. I almost want to see it reversed in some ways, though, because I feel like Jude has so much more control in this whole situation than Carden, and Carden is always a submissive to someone else, like with his brother, whose name I cannot remember.
Balekin.
Yes. And so I feel like maybe Carden needs to have and feel some sense of control in some way, shape, or form. I don't think we're going to get that anytime soon.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I don't know that much about, like, dom-sub relationships.
Oh, I don't know.
So I know that there is, like, a power, and a lot of the part about being a submissive is, like, that is a powerful role.
Oh, interesting.
It's like a reframing of submission as, like, actually a really powerful person to be in this dynamic.
Interesting. Well, then maybe that is what Carden needs. Thinking of that, also that he hates himself for finding a mortal woman attractive, Carden does. Makes me think of, like, people who, like, hate themselves for finding another race attractive or wanting to be with them, which I didn't think about until you said this about the human species race thing.
But that can get, like, really into exploitation and is very, like...
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Very rife with problems. So it's, like, such a delicate topic. I don't know.
I gave you that book, Let's Talk About Love, and they talk about that a little bit in there, about how sometimes your race can be exoticized and how that's not okay.
Sexy times.
Meh. I didn't really like the scene with Jude and Locke, because Locke is an ass, and I hope he dies in the next book. I hope Jude kills him. I'm always wishing death upon people.
Just fairies this time.
But I really love the scene with Jude and Carden. I don't know what that says about me, but...
That makeout scene was pretty hot.
Yeah. I just like Carden is the problem.
Holly Black, you're making me hold out for, like, one makeout scene. Come on. Like, I want more in the next book. I don't know how much more we'll get. I don't know.
I need more Sarah J. Maas levels of explicitness.
Maybe we just both need to read Kingdom of Ash and stop putting it off.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I don't really ship anyone, I guess. Carden and me. Yeah.
I want to see how the Jude Carden dynamic plays out.
I do too. I for some reason, I'm not hopeful about it. They're just going to have to make such a big turnaround.
They're probably going to get together and then they'll break our hearts because Holly Black will, like, make them have to break up or something.
Now we're going to talk about writing style, narration, characterization, plot structure, and basically whatever else comes to mind in a segment called Kill Your Darlings. Jude often breaks the fourth wall and speaks directly to the audience. Not sure how I feel about that. I think it pulls the reader, me, out of the story, and it might be part of the reason I felt like the book was really slow in the beginning.
I didn't notice this, but I respect your opinion.
I don't like it when the narrator talks to me. That's it. I just don't like it.
Don't talk to her.
I don't know why. I always feel like, wait, what? Why? Why is this happening?
Unless it's specifically supposed to be like a sort of confessional.
Right.
I guess if that's a consistent thread throughout the narration, it doesn't strike me as weird.
And you know what? I don't think I have this problem in movies, funny enough.
When, like, the voice in off talks to you?
Yeah, or if, like, in Deadpool, when Deadpool talks to the audience, I'm like, yeah, that's fine. I don't think it bothers me in visual media, but for some reason in reading, I'm like, ugh, why? Don't, no.
I want multiple POVs in The Wicked King.
And I want that other POV to be Cardin's.
I also think it'd be cool if we got a Vivi POV so we could see more about like her dealing with being a hybrid.
For some reason, I feel like we won't get Vivi's POV, but I think it would be great.
Also that then she could specifically talk about not being in a heterosexual relationship.
Yeah, sometimes it's annoying to me, and I say sometimes, but I mean always, when the queer characters are always secondary and not main characters. I'm excited to eventually read A Gentleman's Guide to Vice and Virtue so we can have main queer characters.
One thing that really struck me about this book is Holly Black's prose, and it produces really vivid images. So she incorporates a lot of small details that contribute a lot to the world building and the tone of the work. And this reminded me actually a lot of Cassandra Clare. And turns out they are BFFs IRL. And that makes my heart happy.
I did not know that.
They like have a writing group.
Oh, they wrote a book together.
Yeah, they write books together.
I forgot.
I just think that's lovely.
I'd also like to point out this is not related to writing, but this is where we talk about basically whatever else comes to mind. I really liked the little pictures in the book at the beginning of the chapters and at the beginning of the sections. It felt like a little coloring book. It was a library book, so I couldn't, but I really wanted to color in the little pictures. I think I posted a picture on Insta or Twitter or somewhere.
Did you? Oh my gosh. Well, I listened to the audiobook, so I didn't even see these.
It's like so cute, which is funny because the story is in no way, shape, or form cute.
It's so whimsical.
Yeah. And the story is whimsical, but it's also super violent. So to have these like cutesy pictures at the beginning of the chapters is also kind of interrogates our ideas of what we think of when we think of fairies, I think.
And on the left side of the page, it's always an acorn, which later has meaning in the narrative. And then also on the right side of the page is a mushroom. So that, like, the poison aspect becomes important later of the mushrooms.
Didn't even think about that. Well, it's super cute, and I really liked it. Props to the, you know, art people who do stuff with books. You're doing great.
Definitely. And the, like, the Jude page.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. There's like, you can see like where there's blood. And that I wrote down in my notes. I was like, he obviously is in love with her.
Oh, he's obsessed with her.
Yeah.
And I thought in the audiobook, it was interesting because they read every single Jude.
Because I just looked at it and I was like, I'm good.
No. So in the audiobook, you have to sit through them reading Jude, 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 like 200 times. It was this really
jarring.
Yeah, it was. I like that they did that, though.
I'm going to link to a video that I watched for a class about people designing the book covers of books, because it's really interesting to see how much goes into that. There's actually two videos. One of them is a TED Talk by the guy who did the cover for Jurassic Park, which became the movie symbol for Jurassic Park, which is like what we think of when we think of Jurassic
Park. Just like iconic now.
Yeah, exactly. So it's interesting how those things can kind of influence maybe our readings.
Recommend if you are a fairy nerd or if you want to read some darker YA.
Yeah, pretty dark. Loved it.
In a good way. In an awesome way.
Yeah. And it interrogated a lot of darker themes that we haven't had in earlier books. So I'm really glad for that.
It made for a really intriguing conversation, I would say, this episode.
Agreed.
Before we end, it's time for Real Talk, different new segment. So did reading this book make your perspective change in any way, or did it make you interrogate a concept / system / trend that you hadn't before?
I think that the book made me think differently about the different ways in which emotional and physical abuse can manifest itself in people for personal reasons that I'm not going to go into today, maybe another time. I think that it can be different for other people. And so seeing the way that Cardin dealt with his physical and emotional abuse was interesting to me. And sometimes I think it's important that we think about maybe the hard things that people have gone through, even when they're shitty people.
This book really made me interrogate why I feel the need to like the female characters I read so much. The constraints of likability, basically. And why do I feel like that's necessary in order to connect with the character? Because it's not like I'm 100% likable. It's not like anyone's 100% likable. Also, if you're trying to do that and be likable for everyone, it's not going to work out. Maybe that's just something I'm interrogating in my own life. So that really came up a lot for me in this book.
Thanks for listening to JK It's Magic. We'll be back in 2 weeks for a discussion of Ruin and Rising by Leigh Bardugo. And watch out for the occasional minisode about a range of fantasy adjacent topics.
You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at JKMagicPod. Post or tweet about the show using the hashtag CriticallyReading. Do you have an idea for a book that we should add to our TBR? Email us at jkmagicpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your suggestions.
Know a friend who would enjoy the podcast? Please spread the word. You can subscribe to JK It's Magic on the podcast app of your choice. And if you're feeling benevolent, we'd really appreciate it if you would rate and review the show. JK It's Magic is recorded on lands traditionally belonging to Cheyenne, Ute, and Arapaho Native people. See you in a fortnight. Now we're going to talk about writing style, narration, characterization, plot structure.
Oh my god, we have fucked up every intro to this episode.